thousands of millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
So already well into our summer sesshin, our summer practice period, engaging the precepts, and of course engaging the precepts as our life itself. These teachings that have been passed down to us over 2,000 years. These teachings that in and of themselves have little value, words on a page, a new prescription, but yet all of us here in this room, I think, have found something of value in this tradition, these words that it is up to us to bring them alive. So often in our study, we assume that the meaning is outside of us, and that if we think very hard, we can find that meaning, or perhaps someone else will give us the true meaning. There is no true meaning. There is no teaching. There is no Buddha, no Dharma, no Sangha outside of you. The Buddha taught that we and the world arise simultaneously. This teaching of Praticca Samuppada, dependent co-arising. The self and the world create each other. There is some wonderfully tangled dance. We perhaps imagine if we study long enough we can untangle it. But I think as we move more deeply into this matter, this great matter of life and death, we begin to see that the tangling, the mistaking, one student once called it the intertwinkling. We are all intertwinkling beings, and we twinkle and the world twinkles. And I was touched by what I said in the discussion yesterday. Actually just reminded, of course we say these things and don't know where they come from, but the teaching that everything is included in every part, this is of course the net of Indra, this vast web of interconnection, and at each intersection there is a jewel, and the jewel is called Jan and Dominic and Kath. The jewel has your name, my name. And each jewel perfectly reflects the whole. And so from this teaching or this experience, if this were not so, if everything were not here, the whole universe sitting as we sit, then we would have to go to every corner of the universe to find ourselves, to find the Dharma. But although we use the words relative and absolute, literal, compassion, absolute, each moment contains the whole. So this lovely lineage dedication we chanted is not something that happened long ago. This great tradition that each one of us is heir to is fully present here. I've been rereading one of my favorite teachers and thinkers, David Bowen, who is a physicist and worked with Krishnamurti and had a lot to say about the nature of reality. He saw clearly, and from quite an intellectual viewpoint, but quite a clear, full viewpoint, that this world arises in the interaction. And he had this notion that what he called dialogue groups, that if you got people together, you could begin to see the nature of reality. And he was very specific about how big the group should be. He thought that if it was 10 or 15, it wasn't big enough, because a group of 10 or 15 may be able to get along. He thought the group should be at least 30 or 40, because then it was guaranteed that someone would really piss someone off. And in this arising of anger, in this arising of what he called the impulse of necessity. So we have many thoughts, but one of our most powerful kinds of thoughts is the thought of necessity. I must, you can't. This arising of the assumption. And he said a few things about these groups that I thought were relevant to our work here. He was talking about these groups and the difficulty. And he said, if you sustain it, he might have said, if you sit still, he said, all these problems will arise. If you sustain it, all these problems will arise. It cannot avoid bringing out the deep assumptions of the people who are participating. So our deep assumptions are about who we are and about the nature of the world. These assumptions are incredibly valuable. They allow us to move in the world. And most of the time, they are beneath the level of our awareness. We simply see the world. We simply know how it is. We simply know how we are. And he says it's going to happen that the deep assumptions will come to the surface if we stick with it. If you understand that you have to stick with it, then something new will come. So I think retreat is about sticking with it. About sticking with ourself. And of course, our tendency, as we say over and over again, is to fix ourselves, try to make ourselves better, get rid of the stuff we don't like, add more of the stuff we do like, or to run away. But how do we stick with ourself? It's so clearly not a matter of comfort. There are many pleasures of sesshin. Some people have even told me this is their favorite week of the year. And I think maybe mine. But not in the easy way. For me, the pleasure of our retreat is the intensity of it. We get the opportunity to taste our food. We get the opportunity to feel our feet on the floor, to feel the sweat trickle down the small of our back. And we get the opportunity to once again come up against that which is unacceptable. We get to see ourselves for the thousandth time, the millionth time, move into that place of reactivity. And so easy, as we've said, so easy to imagine that Zen will save us, or being a priest will save us, or something. But our practice is this turning about, turning things on their head. So this place of reactivity, the Buddha spoke of noble truths. His teaching was not the problem with life is that we suffer. The noble truth of life is that things happen. Things in our lives externally, things in our experience, things happen. And that as human beings, we react to what happens. We have emotional responses. This is the noble truth. This is the good news. If you were not reactive, you would not be able to do this work. So that reactivity rises up as some kind of energy. Something provokes it. Something in the external world, something we imagine. Of course, we can't tell the difference. But I think all of us know, just sitting here in the silence, reactivity arises. This is not a problem. We say greed, anger, and ignorance rise endlessly. As long as we are alive, it seems that we will continue in this manner. But the opportunity, and I think the invitations of the precepts, are about how we meet this reactivity, this rising, this emotional imperative. And the teaching is, I think as the great teacher Lin Chi said, do nothing. So what do I do when I feel terrible? Nothing. Sit, breathe in, breathe out. What do I do when I feel wonderful and want to make sure I don't lose this? This same teaching, do nothing. It is in this, the fullness of nothing. In this very last thing we might think to do. We might think of all kinds of skillful means and ways to manage ourselves, ways to move forward in the Dharma. But we are learning to give the gift of letting ourselves be. Letting the world be as it is. And as we more and more deeply let things be as they are, including letting our resistance be as it is. So resistance is a kind of reactivity. I don't want to be here. I don't think this is working for me. I'm not doing it right. This is the truth of the moment. And the encouragement and the promise is that as we move into this, as we take refuge in what is already here, the Dharma, of course, in one wonderful sense, are these beautiful teachings passed down, the writings and the sayings and the reportings. This is the Dharma, but at the deepest level, the Dharma, the teaching, is your life. There is no Dharma outside your encounter with this moment. This is quite radical teaching to make our home where we are, to take refuge not in your capacity as a Zen practitioner, to take refuge not in the depth of practice or not in anything we can imagine, but to turn for refuge to this moment itself. Aliveness in the form of and that as we are able to stick with it, as we are able to allow this rising to be present, to even honor these places, there is the possibility, as David Boehm suggests, for something new to emerge, something unfabricated, something unimagined, something undeserved. This is the sea. We are the waves, complaining of our isolation. And yes, we are the waves, each one of us, in the particular form, the particular gifts, the particular wounds. But the particularity of the moment, the particularity of you, is your great blessing. And it is in the fire of this transformation. This is not an easy task to meet ourselves. And again, we turn the wrong way. Just this morning, as we were doing our Orioki for breakfast, I was giving the signal for past the tea water, and one of my fellow teachers helpfully pointed out that the servers were still eating. And my reaction to this kindness was to go into a state of total reactive shutdown, to go to that place of feeling wrong, feeling less than. And in an instant, the flow of the moment changes. This incredible energy arises. And as we look to our bodhisattva vows, saving the many beings, of course, outside us in the world, but the many beings being the many parts of ourself. So when the heat of this reactivity arises, the heat of our opinion about how it should be, this is not a mistake. As Tori Zenji says, even to our enemies, we should be grateful. This is the Buddha's boundless loving kindness. What if everything that appears is the Buddha's boundless loving kindness? The clarity and the appreciation of the taste of our food, and the clarity and the heat of our opinion, our objection. This gata of atonement we were discussing yesterday, this repentance, also incredibly important part of these precepts. And we talk about 16 precepts, but there is this foundation, there is this that is also the full precepts, this being able to acknowledge when we have been mistaken, and we will be mistaken, we will miss the mark. And this deep acknowledgement, and not the ones, there is a way I think we can apologize and try to pretend it didn't happen. But this is missing the point. Sometimes we will act skillfully and sometimes we won't. Sometimes we will genuinely help people on the way, and sometimes we will be an impediment for others. And we have to walk forward with our life, accept the praise and blame. In the end, we can only do the best we can, and then we walk forward, shouldering what comes our way, not as burden, but meeting our life directly, and acknowledging that this fullness of being human is the heart, is not something that is separate, this persistent idea that we should be different arises again and again, so we can notice it, and we can recommit, we can take refuge. We can turn again to the aliveness of this moment beyond our understanding. We can take refuge in the suchness of the content of this moment, whether it appears to be falling apart or coming together, whether it appears clear or the darkest black ink of night. We can take refuge in the way things are. And here on retreat especially, we can take refuge in each other. The people sitting to your left and your right, sitting in front of you and behind you. They are supporting you. We are all held in this net. So as we turn again and again, as we take refuge, as we find our way and lose it, to realize this all happens in the context of each other. And this most precious gift we call human life. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably. And invite observations, questions. Yeah, you are. Codependent arising. She asked if Josh could talk a little bit.
This concept actually sounds a lot more complicated than it actually is. What we heard, David pointed to one way of saying, of seeing this, which is that this and that arise together. This side is only present with that side. Another thing that this teaching of dependent co-arising or codependent arising, or rising as a codependent. The other thing that this points to is, in a way, a universe in which there is no fixed things, no enduring entities, that the basis of everything is causes and conditions. It's just myriad vectors of causality, myriad lines, many, many forces of influence that give rise to some circumstance. When those causes and conditions change, the thing they've given rise to changes. So this is another side of dependent co-arising. And then it's also related to kind of the, there's no way to separate you out of it. There's no way to separate your success, your failure, from the ownership of the universe. These are some ways that I found into that concept.
And Laura, another way Josh reminded me, there's the touching and there's what is touched. So when you reach out, or there's the ear and hearing. So if there's nothing to hear, can there be hearing? But the car goes by, and the car and the ear create each other, the sound of the car. There is subject and object, as Josh was saying, are interdependent, no subject without object. There is this to touch and be touched by our life.
There's that old question about
Chris, and
perhaps it's my limited dualistic understanding speaking, but it seems like you're saying two things to me, which is, on the one hand, accept everything that arises as a blessing, but then, you know, you also noted times when we feel wrong, or we're causing harm, or we're unhappy, or whatever it might be, and that at such a time, then we turn. Right, or we return to precepts, or we bring attention to bear to change that situation in some way, and which is fine. You know, I guess for me, feeling like I've been in a fairly dark place lately, that just accept that really negative consequences. And so I don't know how to do this juggling game. Does that make sense?
It sure does. I don't know how to do this juggling act is a very important statement to make, to live inside of. I think part of our theme, this Sesshin, around working with the precepts, is to note that there are all these different entry points into practice. There really is a literal, I keep doing this and I'm going to do something else. There really is. You know, don't kill, don't lie, just, you know, get your shit together and stop whining. That's the literal. And then there's the Mahayana, where we really, I mean, who doesn't enter that dark place? I'm not asking for hands. but the dark places, the reactive places, the fearful places, the joyful places, the happy, bliss-filled places, entering into them with the spirit of now this is what's here, and opening arms wide is the Mahayana. It's the compassion. It's all we can do in those moments sometimes. We try to do the literal. I mean, we've been trained that way. Just shape up, kid. You know, what are you doing? You'll get over it, or whatever. Or, oh, poor baby, yes, yes, yes. The literal is what we've been raised on. The wonderful thing about this practice, this compassion orientation, the spaciousness is so great. And then there's the absolute. Emptiness, shunyata, nothing. That's also really, really important, and it's not an idea. You know, we can get into, as beautiful as the answers to dependent co-arising were, to not have experienced it except as a theory, you can't taste it then. And so we have to be careful about getting speculative. That's, you know, the beauty of the bang on the stick. You can't argue with that. Well, I guess you could, trying to protect the floor. So this is, I think, I want to just keep saying it over and over, that there are many gates. In fact, what does it say? What's the line? The Dharma gates are boundless. Dharma gates are boundless. After all these years, I still haven't memorized that version. This is the truth in my experience. I have noted that every time I get it figured out, like even this, there are three ways. Give me a break. That's convenient. But you know that there's no way to. Your last statement, Chris, was the deepest truth. I don't know how to do this. Mo?
Yeah, Mo. Mo.
I was going to say something about the co-arising. That has helped me understand it has been watching an infant grow and the personality changes and develops. But while that is happening, the environment around them is also changed by that growing child. And so that's been a very helpful way for me to understand how they're full size, as if you could just limit it to two sides. But in that way, the child and the environment are both changing and evolving and affecting.
Jeremy, did you have your hand up?
No.
Okay. So, Julie, Sam, and then somebody.
Jeannie's over here, and then there's somebody in the corner.
Okay, Jeannie. Okay.
You're talking about being mistaken and your reactivity to that. That's something I've been working with lately. I was actually reading a book. The title is something like Being Wrong, and it's about how we do so hate to be wrong, and how sometimes accepting that we're wrong sooner could actually free things up and make things to go there. It's kind of bring that up sort of at the psychological level. But one of the interesting things you pointed out that struck with me is that we will often say we were wrong, we have been wrong. We might admit we're human and we will be wrong. Very unusual to say I am wrong. and she goes on to say that, you know, that's very uncomfortable because we define ourselves by our belief and we need that. You know, it's not a Zen book. But the interesting thing there about the phrase I am wrong made me reflect on the Zen practice. And one of the things that the koan training does is get me really used to that. I'm just wrong over and over and over again. And it, you know, brings to mind things like, you know, those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. And sure, you know, you want to do the right, you want to give your kid the right medicine. You really want to be right. But on the other hand, we're also all wrong.
Thank you. Let's see, we got a bunch here, so let's do Sam next.
Okay,
could you speak up a little bit?
I'm gonna put on my quantum physicist hat for a moment. I say that David Bohm brought the idea of dependent co-arising into physics. And if you think about, you know, these people in Europe now who are so gung-ho on the Higgs boson, the question that Bohm would ask is, are they creating the reality, or is it already there? And that is the dependent, can't say it either, dependent co-arising. Is the reality there for us to experiment with and look at, or is it something that we create?
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Maddie, Doug, and Cindy. Oh, and Jeannie.
Ladder, please.
Based on what Sam just said, I would ask you to behave reality as opposed to that. But David, I wanted to say thanks for talking about your own wellness and mistakenness.
And so the content is kind of irrelevant in terms of our study. So what we're studying, it doesn't matter exactly what, you know, whether the line closing up or someone saying something. We begin to see that we can use anything. You know, again, this endless creativity of the human mind. I can be offended by almost anything if I'm in the right place. So that's what we're studying. And then in seeing that there's some possibility, we don't even have to do anything about it. But as we see into it, then there we are. Thank you. What did I say next?
There's Doug.
Oh yeah, James.
Just add one little thing. Also, there's time and place. Our project here is not problem solving. So, in fact, this is a bad place to do problem solving because we have made ourselves particularly raw and opened by this relentless watching. And that's at the end when we do the cautions, we talk about, you know, waiting a little while before getting that tattoo. The solutions that we come up with our problems in Sesshin are rarely the ones that are actually going to fix something. What we're doing instead is we're looking at the meta issue, the deeper issue. What is the field out of which all this arises? And that's a very powerful thing that we've committed ourselves to. And I think David's tracking it really powerfully. I'm very thankful.
So Doug, Cindy, and Jeannie.
David, you say that Lin Shi says that when reactions arise, we should do nothing. Suppose Jeremy grabs the Kyosaku, runs over to you, and takes his best swing at your face. Are you going to react and duck, or do nothing?
Well, Lin Shi didn't say, he said do nothing. I don't know what context he was using. But I'm saying in this context of practice, and I think as James just said, of course there are times when we really need to do something. This is not an all-out immobility. And as Melissa was saying, that the skillful means is different every time. There's no, so if we get in the fixed position, oh, do nothing. I think you're correctly pointing out that is not serviceable in all situations. Or would lead to interesting things, but in the context of our training here, we are protected by the container of our rules, our guidelines, and so it allows us to practice this wildly absurd notion. And again, as James said, when we leave retreat there, it's different. Different things required.
And what we've done here will make us, hopefully, incline us a little more gracefully in this world. Perspective becomes bigger. Options become wider. Many things.
Yeah.
The practice of doing nothing on our cushion in Zazen enables us to more flexibly do something. It enables us to be able to return to our aspirations to cease from harm, return to our aspirations to do good, and rather than just reacting, finding more choicefulness in being skillful and kind.
I just want to add to that the word flexibility. There is this real quality of not being, as David was saying, fixed.
So Cindy, then Jeannie.
What was brought to mind was choosing what you have, and I enjoyed that couple pages in your book where you're describing handing thousands of orchestrating the traffic on the street and creating that, and that just spoke to me playfully of choosing what I have rather than being annoyed by the car or the hawk or the traffic or the truck or the, you know, whatever it is, just being there. And the intensity of sitting here the first day and not being able to get up and duck in the normal ways that I cope was very, very informative. And I went a lot of years without a sangha or a teacher. And you can practice by yourself, but it's much better with others for either the power of bad example or the power of wonderful example.
We divvy those jobs up.
And I've noticed that the noticing and the owning and the doing nothing is a choice in itself, and it sometimes requires doing something, and sometimes it takes me a really long time to get over being scared as shit to do something that it needs doing.
Yeah.
And it's still important, and somehow it makes me a bit kinder and more compassionate to all others. Grateful for that softening, because that hard shell feels really awful for the inside.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So. Jeannie?
So I've been holding this question, I think, since yesterday. It was James. He talked about historically looking at the precepts changing, or the precepts themselves changing, yeah? And I've been appreciating how we've been looking at the precepts from many angles and views. But it made me curious, how do any of these views, or actually the actual changes in the precepts, affect the essence of the practice? You know, culturally, from India to China to Japan to this country, is there any essential change, just, you know, kind of prescribed for our behavior in those changes?
Well, I think that the dramatic example would be around sexuality. Very clearly, the normative understanding of sex in the classical Buddhist period is it's not a good idea, and the normative position is celibacy, and then there's various compromises with reality. And for me, what I see in the evolution of this is that there is a heart to this that can embrace the reality of our being sexual beings, and that we don't have to have celibacy as the normative position, and still find the heart of what's being presented. And would somebody from the 4th century before the Common Era agree? You know, who cares? What matters is, are we finding our hearts being liberated? Are we living with our bodies in a more honest and fruitful way because of this gift that we were originally given to call our attention to it, but to continue looking without being trapped by the literal or the compassionate or the boundless, and informed by all.
James?
So I really appreciated the pointing to that enormous energy that comes up when we get reactive, right? Like it's like you can just feel it. It's like something got turned on, right? Like, where was that energy the second before that? But boom, there it is. And for me, it wants to go to a particular place. Like, it has a direction. And Africa wants to go there with all its might. And then this, you know, codependent arising that when attention, you know, what we're sort of practicing here, just accidentally, whatever, we get lucky and it shows up at the same time. Something does, like, choices, opportunities maybe to take that energy into different directions show up. I mean, sometimes I still go the way that it wants to go anyway, because, you know, to pick something else, I feel gypped. But I know it's okay. Left is probably better for everybody. But sometimes I just go right, because, God damn it, that feels like the right thing to do. And I know it's the wrong thing to do. But I love that, you know, for so long, maybe that's the spaciousness, right? The not being able to see it as just this, it's just energy, right? And it has infinite possibilities.
Right.
But it doesn't tell you that on the front end. It says this one thing.
And I think when we let it run the show, we get into trouble, right? That there is this karmic force of the ancient wounds and sins of our parents and their parents. And I love, there's something that's so juicy about it. You know, and I love it, feeling gypped. Yeah, but if I can't lash out or act out, is life worth living? And so then we act it out, and then we get the reaction, oh, it seemed like a good idea. You know, I'm going to complete it. You know, this time it'll work. But I think until we feel the seduction of that, until we realize the power of that and the appearance of, you know, that we don't stand a chance. So, thank you. Maybe just a couple more back, so Mike and Aaron. Yeah.
The one thing, feeling like there is something in the center of it that I need to figure out, mm-hmm. has been what has drawn me for so long with particular demons, especially shame for me. Like, there is really something wrong with me, and I got to find that one thing.
Yeah.
And if I can figure that out, then I can resolve all that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I can put it away because I'll have it fixed up.
Yeah.
And so I look and I look and I spend 1,000 years looking for this one little thing, and it shapeshifts on me over and over and over. Oh, it's because I did this. It's because I did that. Oh, it's because I'm just bad. Oh, it's because everybody else is bad. on. And it becomes this amazing thing that why is this shapeshifting if it's just one thing? Like, So I have to keep looking, and I realize that it's all situational, and it's this whole codependent thing that we're talking about. There's no center to it. You know, so I can chase my own tail for 1,000,000 years looking for the one thing at the center, and there's no center to it at all.
Amen.
Thank you.
Is it good?
It's actually...
Oh, it's both?
I've seen the translation.
Okay.
Josh.
I don't know what we're talking about.
We're just conferring. Usually, I've seen a dependent co-arising.
Yeah.
But codependent arising has a nice feeling to it. Kind of rolls off the tongue as well. So
very American.
We'll use both here. And Aaron.
So, for a couple of years of practicing, I figured out
louder.
I really, really like to feel good.
He really, really likes to feel good.
I really like feeling good. Louder. I like feeling good.
Alright, yeah, me too! Yes. Thank you very much, Aaron.
So, when the world doesn't make me feel good, emotionally or physically, there it is, like there's the problem. And then there's the anger and the stories. But of course, you know, nothing makes me feel good all the time. And, you know, nothing makes me feel bad all the time. And I certainly, I don't think I can do this practice if it didn't make me feel good sometimes. But, you know, so this morning I'm stewing in my anger over, you know, some story in my head. And, you know, it was a nice moment where I could recognize that I was angry. And it allowed me to kind of get out of my head and focus on what that anger was doing. And there was a lot of energy. And it allowed so I was angry for a while, but, you know, that became okay. And then, of course, it changed.
And I think you point to that, the function of story, and we've talked about it often, but when we're lost in it, this is not about repeating the same story over and over again and hoping it'll go somewhere new. But those moments for all of us when we get just a hair's breadth of space between the brain and the skull, and we can begin to say, oh, anger, and to recognize it for what it is, an arising of you know, hotness, heat, whatever, then we don't have to follow it in the same way.
And so it seems to work with all emotions, but it doesn't make the emotion go away. So the sadness and despair that I have doesn't go away just because I recognize it. It's, oh, now I'm sad. It doesn't change it, but there is something.
Why don't we stop there for today? Thank you.